morning, wake up, wake. Good morning, wake up, wake. Good morning, wake up, wake. Wake up and get yourself to church, yeah.
Thank you guys all for tuning in. We're glad to do another installment of CDA Live. I'm really excited to have my good friend, longtime friend, Ralph Plum here. We're excited to hear about his life, where he's been, both athletically and in business. Ralph, tell us about your life growing up in the Brick Alley pub world with parents working crazy hours, you and your brother Matt. Doing your thing. Tell us about that.
So it's kind of weird now, as being a parent, you don't realize all the other things that are going on during all that kind of craziness. But my parents bought Brick Alley and started Brick Alley in 1980. Uh-huh. So I wasn't born yet. I was born in 83. So all I knew was that life, that restaurant business. So in the summer, my parents worked a ton, obviously being down there. So my brother and I used to go to sport camps almost all summer long. We'd go to one was a hockey camp at Providence College, and there's four sessions of it. We'd go to all four sessions. My parents would always come up and see us and all that stuff. Yeah. But they were that's their prime time is during the summer months. In the winter, we grew up skiing a lot. Go on ski vacations. So a lot of people in the summer would take vacations and go to the lake and all that. For us, it was the opposite. The summer was a busy time for us, not only with sports and activities, but my parents at the restaurant and. And in the winter, we did our kind of family activities and vacations and things of that nature. But it's really interesting. I've seen over the years, like the different people my parents have been able to impact from whether they're employees, whether they're team members or people in the community. It's been really nice to see as I've gotten kind of more involved and just people pulling me aside. And whether it's employees that have worked there for a long time or whether it's different vendors or different people. So
your dad made a big impact on my life. And one of the things that struck me was how much the employees cared about him and he about his employees. And I think, working in restaurants myself and obviously being an architect for many restaurants, there's almost this weird dynamic at odds between ownership and the, wait staff and the cooks and stuff. It's almost like they're on a different teams. And man, your parents, it was the opposite, it seemed like. And you've told me about things that go on there as far as how much the staff loves your parents and vice versa. Any of that that sort of rubbed off on you?
Yeah, exactly. And frankly, I've seen it with the pandemic and everything going on in the restaurant business now. Just a little example of like my mom, who's, could easily kind of hang it up and kind of go into the sunset, if you will. But she's been down there doing doubles and managing and in the floor, and she's in it, right? Yeah. And so I think it's a great example of leadership comes in a lot of different forms. A lot of people know my dad as the kind of the face of the restaurant and the leader and the visionary, and which he is and has been for a long time. But my mom has been that person, in the trenches a lot of times with the staff, with the team. And so there's a lot of different types of leadership, and as we look forward, how do we bridge that gap, and how do we fill those two voids, that are gonna, come at some point, right? And so it's amazing the feedback I get from staff about, oh my gosh, your mom's, and we've known that for a long time.
Yeah, she makes the trains run on time, right?
Oh my, to say the least.
And your dad's the visionary out there, the front man.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
And man, they're both really special people. So you're tremendously blessed to come from those two great human beings. But tell us about, you were going to all these athletic camps, and then, I'm interested to hear about sort of when you started picking sports and how sports and high school life kind of came together. And then ultimately you went to a college and how that went, from an athletic standpoint.
So athletics has always been a big part of my life. Played men's league hockey last night, still trying to not pull a hamstring. But so growing up, athletics was always a big thing for us. It has been in our family for a long time. Like my grandfather played at Springfield College back in the 1930s, both football and hockey. So it's been ingrained in us. And, my dad used to always tell us, look, you don't have to work at the restaurant all the time, but you got to be doing something. So natural gravitation to both my brother and I was with athletics. And, you know, I really enjoyed hockey growing up. I didn't really enjoy football that much when I was really little. But once I got to high school, and at Portsmouth High School, football's always been, you know, the sport. We're a small school, public school, you know, 750, 800 kids. And, you know, historically, going back to the, you know, Duke Ingrams and other people coming up in the, you know, the 90s and Mike Clouds and all these guys, I was young going to those games and watching them play and them go on to play like Division I football. And it was pretty special. Like people competing against Hendricken and LaSalle with a small school, public school like that. And we lose guys to go to those schools as well. When I played against Hendricken my sophomore year in the state championship, and we won the Division I state championship, the two best players at Hendricken would have been at Portsmouth High School. So Portsmouth football has always been kind of a big thing in our life, and it's weird. I had a couple mentors through that process. Like I mentioned Duke Ingram, but Duncan Ingram, starting in like seventh grade, he would bring like middle school kids. We would go to the gym at the high school every day after school, and he would be there, and the coaching staff for the football program would be there. So I learned early, like, we put in a lot of work, more so than I think the average high school around here was putting in work in the weight room.
Program,
and
just,
the feeder program, not only Pop Warner, but even all, like training behind the scenes, right?
Wow.
So that was a great experience. Lucky to still know both those guys, and had a big impact in a lot of our lives and my personal life. But then, you know, the recruiting process starts, you know, because you get all these letters, you have all these coaches coming in, and, you know, it's like, I wanted to go where someone you feel wanted, right?
Yeah.
And those two were the Naval Academy and Yale were the two that I narrowed it down to. I ended up choosing Yale to go, and it was probably the best decision I made at that point in my life.
Okay.
I got introduced to, because, you know, in Newport, in Portsmouth where I grew up, not a ton of diversity on a lot of levels. And going to Yale, you're just thrown into just a global, you know, pot of every background, ethnicity.
Okay.
A lot of people have a misconception about Yale and
okay.
the other Ivy Leagues about, oh, it's a lot of this and that. They do an amazing job of bringing in people from all different thoughts and backgrounds, and it was amazing.
So I love the small school, because typically people think you go to a small school, you're sort of like, well, there's always these other schools in high school and college. But you're saying the small school may have helped you because there was this like intensity of like, we got to get these kids up to speed. We only have so many kids and we're losing some of them to other schools that are recruiting away from us. And so it was almost like you had to bear down because there was only so many, right?
Our coaches did a great job of that in high school. We would show up with 30 guys.
Yeah.
And we'd look across the sideline at Hendricken and there would be 110 guys,
right.
right? Or like LaSalle or East Providence. And he did an amazing job of building up the underdog, building up that. I mean, oh man, I still remember his pregame speeches, stuff of legend, stuff that probably couldn't say now, 20 years later. But I look back and I really believe that not just myself, but a lot of people I've played with were impacted positively because of, at the time, a lot of things that happened. I mean, I quit one day.
Really?
Oh, my sophomore year, he broke me. I'll never forget this. My friends still make fun of, you know, get on me about it. But I remember we were running and running and running, and I mentally broke.
Yeah.
Walked off the field, quit, done, this, that. And the best part was, he didn't chase me. He didn't ask me. He didn't, all right, see you later. You know what I mean? And, you know, you expect, I remember thinking back, like a part of me was like, wait, no one's going to come get me, you know? And I remember going home and telling my parents this, and they're like, well, you better call him.
Yeah.
Glad my parents made me deal with that,
right.
You know, but I remember that situation. But small school, small environment. And right now they're back. I mean, they were in the state championship game last year in Division One. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
And they, you know, playing against Hendricken, that guy's going to Michigan and Notre Dame all this stuff, which is really, really cool to see.
I'd love to hear about the Yale experience. And I know just a little bit about the things that you accomplished there. But, you know, tell us, brag a little bit about your things that happened there. And, you know, you were a quarterback and you switched to wide receiver and just kind of the accolades that came out with that.
A lot of success in athletics is your team and situation, right? Like, if Tom Brady was not put around Bill Belichick early in his career, you could argue, you don't know, right? Yeah, and right. Same thing about Belichick, right? So I went to Yale and I was a quarterback. And one of the reasons why I went there was because I wanted to play quarterback. Half the teams recruited me to play different positions. Okay. Like Brown wanted me to play defensive back. And I was like, So I wanted to play quarterback or at least give it a shot, knowing that there was a chance I'd probably end up moving because I didn't have the drop back, like deep out on a rope. But I would more like make plays. And the other quarterback that came in as a freshman, so there were 9 quarterbacks when I showed up at Yale, wow. Just on Yale's team. So there's 9 quarterbacks. All were obviously good. One of the kids in front of me took over for Drew Brees at Austin Westlake, Texas, where okay. Drew Brees went, yeah. where Nick Foles went. So he was the starting quarterback there. One guy, the kid in my class, the other quarterback, was second team All-State Pennsylvania, who ended up being on the Dallas Cowboys practice squad for a couple years at quarterback. So these were some of the quarterbacks in the program.
Sure.
And I'm looking around, and I'm on like the 5th field. So like in camp as a freshman, and the starters are like, you can't even see them, they're so far away. And I've always been someone that wants to play and be involved. Like I've I'm sitting there like on day 3 or 4 and I'm just like, how am I going to get on the field?
Yeah.
And I've always had a sense of urgency to try to solve problems, which in some ways is good, in some ways it's not good, but for this story it's good.
Yeah.
And my problem was I wanted to play, so I went to the coaches after practice and was like, hey, can I play wide receiver? And because we had a couple
receivers. You came to them.
Oh, yeah. And they also, in college, there's a lot of guys that play college football. I mean, Julian Edelman's a great example. Yeah. Julian Edelman played actually quarterback in college as well.
Oh.
He didn't even play receiver.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, he played quarterback at Kent State. So there's a lot of, they recruit a lot of quarterbacks. Because a lot of times in high school, guys get put a quarterback that can make plays or do whatever. And so they kind of, they weren't going to force it on me because they knew I wanted to play quarterback too. Yeah, they let,
right.
But my sense of urgency popped up and I said, can I play receiver? And I also, there were a couple receivers that were freshmen and sophomores that were like on field too.
Yeah.
That I said, I remember saying to myself, I'm like, I think I could be better than that guy. By the end of the year, I was starting, and it was a really great experience. It's amazing how it changes over 4 years. If you're a freshman, everything's moving so fast and like you don't know what's going on and you're like nervous. And my first ever catch was like a 40-yard touchdown against Brown.
Wow.
And that was my first catch. And Brown
was a good one.
And they were like my spurned lover. Like I was so mad about Brown. My biggest games in my career were against Brown.
Okay.
I was furious because they recruited me hard as a quarterback.
Okay.
Because the way recruiting process works, going back to like, you want to go where they want you.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted me as a quarterback initially. You're going to be the next, Then they got their quarterback. So like, they're recruiting. They're not recruiting one guy.
Right.
They're recruiting, let's say, 15 quarterbacks, 20 quarterbacks. It's amazing. Like, I think they got their guy that they wanted.
Sure.
So they then like immediately one day it was like, I think you should play defensive back in the recruiting process. I was like, all right, guys.
You're done.
And ever since then, I was furious with them. And so that was one of the best moments of my career was my freshman year. My first catch and my first touchdown was against Brown. In the Yale Bowl, which was a cool experience. Was really fortunate. I filled in, so I got the number 4 when I went as a quarterback. And then when I changed to wide receiver, they gave me like number, I don't know, some number that's like...
Oh, not a good number.
Not a good number. No, number. See, you're a wrestling guy.
I don't know anything about numbers.
Like, you got to have a good number, right? So your number says a lot about who... So what happened when Cam Newton came to the Patriots?
Yeah.
He got his number 1.
Yep.
He's not gonna. Okay. They're not gonna give Cam Newton number 6. His number's number 1.
Okay.
He's gonna get his number. Brady went to Tampa Bay. What'd they give him?
12.
12. Right. So they like your number says a lot about what they think about you and what position. More on that later. but I got some weird number when I moved to wideout.
Okay.
But then as I started playing a little bit and competing, and I think the coaches saw a niche for me.
Okay.
And that niche had just been vacated by a guy. He graduated the year before I got there.
Mm-hmm.
This kid, Eric Johnson, who ended up playing for the San Francisco 49ers for like 4 or 5 years, and then for the New Orleans Saints for a number of years. So he played like 8 years in the NFL.
Yeah.
And now he's married to Jessica Simpson. It's this guy. Yeah, yeah,
jeez.
He's actually, he's been to Brick Alley along with Jessica Simpson a few years back. They were in town for a wedding. So he's become a friend over
nice,
the years.
Nice.
But he vacated that position. He left, and he was the all-time leading receiver at Yale before I had gotten there.
Mm-hmm.
So in camp, as I started as a freshman, they said, all right, this guy might be able to be EJ. That was his nickname. Yeah. And so they gave me 21, which was his number.
All right.
So that's when I said, all right. They so they gave me 21, and they were like, you need to do what he does. So all I did was watch his film, study what he did, mm-hmm. what routes did he run, how did he do, and I just watched every film they had, and I just kind of filled into that void.
All right.
And that's why I brought up your situation, your coaching staff. Like, I fell into a nice niche with my skill set and what had come before me to be able sure. to have some, you know, good career over the 4 years.
Now, I'd like to hear about just D1 sports in general. And Yale's is like another weird twist, I would assume.
Absolutely.
Versus a Big Ten school or something, but...
It's not a Big Ten school.
I mean, are you lifting? Are you eating like 10 meals a day? Are you sleeping 10 hours a day?
So Yale's an interesting place, in the whole Ivy League athletics is an interesting place because academics is number one in these Ivy League institutions. And most of us go there, obviously, for that opportunity, right? Mm. But we're also athletes at heart, and you know, so there's this weird mix. You know, there's a lot of working out, a lot of structure, a lot of rigidity to it. I don't know. It was what I knew, right?
Okay.
And I enjoyed that part of it. There were some guys that weren't as committed to their craft, to their athletic career, that did, you know, show up late. I don't know. For me, it was easy. It was like I was the first guy in, last guy out.
Yeah. You've been doing it since middle school or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
a lot of these guys were too, but it's just that was always my mentality. If I wanted to get ahead and I wanted to, you know, move up that depth chart and you know, accomplish the goals I had, you know, I don't know. It was a fun time. It's definitely not the Big Ten experience. We had one game that was like the Harvard game.
Okay.
Because you have, you know, 55,000-60,000 people there for that game.
Yeah, yeah.
But otherwise, at Yale Bowl, we play with a 70,000 person stadium, you know, and you're playing Holy Cross.
Yeah.
There's, 15,000 people in the stadium. It looks like there's nobody there. Definitely not like the Horseshoe against Nebraska, like I was there a couple years ago, and had a little different experience.
Big time.
A little bit different.
The whole state shows up. I know you had some accomplishments there, so at like wide receiver and all that.
You're gonna make me talk numbers?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Come
well,
on,
the
man.
Good news,
that's
so I, well, the good.
That's what I want to hear.
Well, my one of my records, actually, both of them just got broken.
Forget that.
So they're all gone.
I'm
now.
Still living in the
I might have like one. Era. I have one like one niche record, like some little thing. No, I went on to have the most receptions, the most yards as a receiver in my career at Yale, which was a fun experience.
All time. You were
all time. Yeah.
Wow.
We've been playing football for a long time.
Because Yale's a brand new school, so
you could
easily get
on. That was one of the things that got me to go there too. I'll never forget just the history of Yale, like Walter Camp, and you know, you walk in. I remember on one of my visits there, you walk in the football office. They have two Heisman trophies sitting there, you know, from 1936 and 1934.
There's still Heisman trophies.
But what's cool is my grandfather played against one of those guys.
Okay.
So when my grandfather was at Springfield College, he played against Yale.
Oh, wow. You finish up Yale. I'm assuming that's a crazy experience, both athletically and academically. And then you're out on the streets. You know, you're the hero football player. You just graduated.
Not at Yale.
Yale
doesn't have hero football players.
No?
They have hero scientists.
You're my hero if you were the top wide receiver in school history. You got all this fanfare. Things are great. You just graduated from Yale. And then what?
My goal going to Yale, like when I was through that, I was an economics major,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to go work on Wall Street and finance. That was my goal. And I worked for a guy named Jonathan Bush, who was former President Bush, like the old Bush's brother, and HW's uncle.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Yale guy, and he had a little money management firm in New Haven. So I got this job as a sophomore, working in this 5-person investment office. I ended up basically doing all the research by the time I was a senior. It was an amazing gig.
Wow.
Like,
nice.
He was an another amazing influence on my life. I'll never forget, I walked into his office one time. He asked me to do a research report, and I did an average job on it. And I remember he sat me down, and he's the nicest, kindest guy, but he just put it aside, and he just flat out told me it was not good. And I'll never forget that feeling of disappointment I had. And this guy that I really looked up to, because he introduced me to a lot of people. I mean, I'll never forget, I used to drive him to New York, and he'd be on the phone, he'd be, Ralph, call this person. I mean, it really, really cool experience.
Yeah.
You know, he'd be talking to his brother on the phone, on speakerphone, like, wow. You know, just,
yeah.
And very down-to-earth people. And then when I went to go, after I graduated, I interviewed with, you know, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, and all these big banks. He like helped me get, because my GPA was not a 3.8. To interview at Goldman, coming out of school, you generally need a 3.5 just to apply.
Yeah.
I didn't have that, partially because I struggled early on in my career. I took it seriously, but I was a little overmatched. So I got job offers from Credit Suisse, like an investment bank, and Lehman Brothers, and these different banks. But I also, my senior year, got approached by sports agents to go try to play in the NFL. So Eric Johnson, the guy who came before me in my college career, his agent approached me as well and said, hey, he just, you know, Eric now was his fourth year in the league, playing for the 49ers. And Eric, at one year, he had like 100 catches in the NFL in a single season.
Wow.
So he was not a, you know, he played.
Yeah.
He was the tight end when Jeff Garcia and T.O. were on the Niners. And
okay.
He was the tight end making plays. And so this agent approached me, and long story short, I signed with him after school, and I put on 40 pounds between my senior year, when I finished my senior year in November after the Harvard game. I put on 40 pounds in about 4 months. And it was crazy. And people first
react. Different human being.
Different. I was massive. And people, I got up to like 268 pounds. And people were like assuming I was on steroids.
Yeah,
and I've always been someone that, if you can't do it,
right.
You know. So I ate and trained and ate and trained and ate and trained. And
you weren't doing that during football season?
I already was 225 pounds as a wide receiver,
right.
And that was a forced weight. I weigh less than I do now. I weigh less now than I did when I graduated high school. It was always a pressure for me to put on weight, but it was even more so.
Okay.
So then after school, I signed with the Oakland Raiders as an undrafted free agent. Went out there to mini camp. And practice with guys like Randy Moss, Warren Sapp, and all these guys. It was
cool.
A really cool experience. Looking back, I probably put on too much weight because you're in this mode of like trying to get bigger and bigger and bigger, get bigger, stronger, faster. Yeah. I probably should have, that's neither here nor there, but I got cut, released. My agent wanted me to go like, hey, go to NFL Europe because that still existed, or Canada. I was just like, you know what? I'm done. So I had this weird gap. I was telling someone this story the other day where like, I got these job offers to go work in finance, and they thought it was awesome that I was going to go, like, I had an agent, was going to go try to play in the NFL. They were like, oh my gosh, that's all they wanted to talk about with me.
Right.
So when I told them I was going to sign and pursue that and decline the job offers, they were like, awesome, call us when your career ends, right? So then my career, I forced my career. I was like, yeah, I'm done. This is now like 4 months, 5 months after graduation. So I'm like, I got like a year to just go do something without having to like, actually get a job at one of these, because at a certain point they're not going to give you, you know, they're going to be like, I can't call them 5 years later and be like, all right, I'm ready for the job, right? But I figured I had a little bit of time. So I went and worked with a couple buddies of mine who I'm still partners with to this day down in New Haven flipping houses.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first entry into real estate. I always had this entrepreneurial bug, partially because my parents had never worked for someone.
Yep.
So I didn't know anything different. And these were guys that I'd known, they're older than me, they're like 5 years older than I am, but we had a similar mindset and approach and personalities, and I thought it would be fun. And
totally different world than anything else
totally
you were
different,
doing.
Totally
right?
Different world.
Because real estate's not in your background or at that point.
Other than living in houses and...
You've lived in a house. Yeah,
well. Yeah I did. That's, you know, I knew nothing about it, and it was just... a really great experience being around, and to be frank, they were figuring it out.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm sure they'd say the same thing. Like, we were working our tails off, educating ourselves, and I think the key was there was a lot of good people together, you know? It was like people that were willing to figure it out and share resources and stuff like that. So I went and worked with them for about a year, and they were on Flip This House in New Haven back, this was back when Flip This House was like at its peak. This was 2005, 2006.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it was 15 years ago now.
Yeah.
So I was on a few episodes of that with them, and they took it to the, again, my sense of urgency, I'm like, I want to get my own thing going. And so when I originally went to work with them, it's like, hey, I'll be here for a year, but I eventually want to go back to Rhode Island and do my own thing. And that was the original deal. And I ended up sticking to that, coming back to Rhode Island, starting a couple companies and doing that. And they stuck with that, and they just blew up.
Okay.
I mean, blew up. And they're doing amazing to this day. And I still work with them, and I've gone back with them and still do a lot of stuff. But that's kind of how I entered entrepreneurship was I had this gap to where I didn't have to. And a lot of my friends who went to go work in finance, they were pulling all-nighters, and you know, they're the new guys on the street.
To prove themselves.
That's it, right? Yeah. And I was like, I was just having fun with these guys I enjoy working with. So
great.
That was the entry into it.
Well, that brings me to the spot where I met you, which was your dad calling me and saying, hey, my son's in town, which I didn't know anything other than I briefly knew about the football thing. And I'm starting Courts and Design right around that point. And he's like, you know, he's here to build houses. And so I think we did some small job to begin with, you and Mike Marcello throwing hammers around in some addition. And then, you know, you guys did it and knocked it out and gave you another small job. And we just kind of made our way together for a little bit.
06, 07. So 13, 14 years ago. So, I mean, I was doing some investing, but also I said, you know, I started this building company with a friend of mine, Mike. And, you know, you look back retroactively, you're like, man, I knew nothing. Right? When you're, and I wish I would have known then what I know now type stuff. But it was a great experience. Always enjoyed working with you. And I remember when I met you, you're working for another firm. And I'm like, I'll never forget this. I'm like, this guy, talking about you, is like easy to work with, dynamic, you do a great job. Like, you're in, like, I had struggled with other architects and other situations. I'm like, why don't you do your own thing? You know, I remember that discussion, and I'm glad you did. And it's so awesome to see what you've done.
Well, thanks. So, okay, so you got this building company, and then tell me about the transfer of that to what you do now.
Yeah, so I was doing a lot of building. We did a lot of fun stuff. Like, we built the first ever LEED certified house here in Newport County, Rhode Island, fourth in the state. And a lot of fun projects. That one that we did with that Nana wall overlooking the ocean, you know, like, there was a lot of fun stuff. There was also some stuff I didn't enjoy about that business. Some of those projects, you're in big projects with people for a long time.
Yeah.
And like 95% of the clients I had, like, some of them I like would have worked for free. They were like amazing. But every once in a while I had a situation that just, you're like in this partnership for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
I like some of them. And I had, you know, 20 employees at one point, and and it just was something that I didn't see myself wanting to do for and grow big and get bigger and all this stuff. So I wound it down. The guys who I had partnered with in New Haven, or worked with in New Haven at first, I had always done stuff with them. Like, they'd call me, we'd work on a project together, something like consulting, will. And they had been trying to get me back to, like, the thing I've observed from my partners out in California is they try to find the right people and they figure out the rest. So I remember, I look at them when they were trying to recruit me back, they're like, they didn't really know exactly how I'd fit in, but they thought that, and I thought the same way, we would work well together and figure something out.
Yeah.
And I could find my niche with them. And they were right, and it worked out. But that's, I've seen them do that with 30 people. People that they think they can work well with, and they figure out opportunities as their business grows and gets vertical and things like that. So it's been a great experience with them. I went to San Diego where I was primarily out there for a while, and helped get a company off the ground with them that's still running today and, and doing well. But it's a very COVID-affected business. When COVID first hit, I was in Florida with my wife and kids. And we were having, we're in the live events business. And we put on large events all throughout the country, lots of them every single week. So basically the goal is get as many people in a ballroom as close together for 3 days as possible.
Yeah.
Probably the worst COVID, by the way, get on airplanes to go there. Probably the worst COVID business. And I'll never forget when I was in Florida with my family, and literally were like, this event, this governor changed this, this governor changed this, this governor. And it was like, meanwhile, I'm on the phone with my brother with the restaurant. That was when they were talking about canceling St. Patrick's Day Parade, which is our busiest day at Brick Alley all year. Like, people look at Newport as a summer town. The number one busiest day is St. Patrick's Day. And they were talking about canceling that. So, like, I remember just, and I'm pretty good about checking out when I'm on vacation. But I was like, this was like
this is different.
Next level. And I remember just watching it go. And the good thing, I've always been real, and like being a son of a business owner, like knowing like it's not, things will change. Things will, the economy is going to have cycles to it. Like you can't look at what you made this year and extrapolate out, you know, for the next 40 years every year. If I could do, that with my best year, then we're good. But it just was a really interesting time over the last 6 months where, you know, our businesses have been majorly affected by COVID, which, you know, the good news is, and we're very blessed and fortunate that we've made some good decisions to where it's going to be okay, right? Like, you're not going to have your top end like you had in some other years, but we haven't lived excessively. We haven't like gone, we've invested, you know, so it's going to be all good. And right now I'm in this like phase of, okay, what's next, right? And like, what's the next evolution? And right now it's the restaurants and working with my brother and getting those back, you know, because COVID's going to go away. I mean, no one knows when, but eventually, I mean, you know, at some point, and I think it's longer term than shorter term, personally. That's my personal opinion. But, you know, so how do you prepare for that? How do you work with staff to help them navigate through some of this, just psychologically and even financially with some things going on, right? Yeah, so it's certainly been a challenge, to say the least.
You were doing these live events. Just tell us about the live events just briefly.
So we would do training. So we do real estate investor trainings throughout the country. So the largest real estate education company in the country.
So if I wanted to get into the house flipping or wholesaling or whatever business in real estate, I would see your course and
even
I would sign up for it. You would teach me over the course of a weekend kind of the basics?
I would do 3 days. Some not so basic, but that was the challenge, right? Is when we do these trainings, you have let's say 300 people in a room, you have someone with X experience, you have someone with Y experience, you know, and balancing that out.
Right, throwing a lot of terms around and
You teach a model. you try to teach a business model over 3 days. And it's certainly that was a fun challenge and really enjoyed that, and also getting that enthusiasm across to people, and I'm pretty passionate about doing it well. Anything well, right? Like a lot of people think with real estate or any investment class. Right now it's In the stock market, you know, my background initially in investing was in the markets. One of the guys I studied with, a guy named David Swensen, who manages $40 billion, the Yale Endowment, and the average investor is trying to compete and get returns against guys like that. I think any investing strategy, the more prepared you are, the better educated you are, the better decisions you're going to make. Rising tides go up, your investment goes up, but what do you do when things don't go well? How do you know how to navigate those waters and things? So our journey, when we were young, I was 22 when I started, they were like 27 or five, and we had a decade of experience kind of teaching that experience. Was a lot of fun. And the people I did it with was even more fun. I just developed some great relationships with, you know, coworkers and people over the years from all across the country.
Did you ever put those into practice? Meaning, did you invest? Do you do that sort of real estate work yourself?
I do. I still do. I look at real estate investing really as like, there's kind of three main ways people can do it. One, they can be like the active participant, right? So they're out there, you know, buying their own rental property, or, you know, they're the full equity stakeholder in any asset, right? They go and buy it. They might borrow money too, but they're out there. It's them in a real estate transaction, whether it's rehabbing it and trying to sell it for profit or buying and holding it, right? Number two, people can be like passive investors. So they invest money in other people's transactions or deals and get paid passively through that. And then number three is someone could be like a fund investor, like buy into a REIT or, you know, different types of funds, right? So I do all three. I've learned over the years that you can only be so much of an active investor, right? Like a lot of guys, you only have so much time and even bandwidth. to scale that, right? Mm-hmm. So how much are you going to do at once? And I have other businesses too, so it's not, I've gotten better over the years at like, all right, take that on, don't take that on.
Okay.
Just because you can make money on something doesn't mean it's a good thing to take on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, in my early 20s, and it was like, if it can make money on it in business, do it, right? But as you start learning about business better, it's like, all right, how much do I have to put in on this? What is that going to take away from?
ROI.
Is it worth ROI of time, right?
Yeah,
and energy and mental stress. Yeah. So, so I do projects actively. I don't do a ton of flips anymore. Like the last couple of years, I've, you know, bought some land, built a couple of houses, mm-hmm. Things like that. The new restaurant that we have here in Middletown, mm-hmm. that you did a bunch of work with us on and designing and helping with plan and getting through zoning.
Sure, sure.
You know, we took that asset, 1.2 acres on a corner of two state roads. So like that's a nice long-term play for us too. So yeah. I don't do, right now in my career, I do a lot more like longer-term investing type stuff. When I was younger and trying to grow and build, it was a lot of, you know, active like, flipping of properties, I still look at opportunities all the time.
Yeah.
And then I invest in some apartments in different parts of the country, a lot in Dallas, Fort Worth, a lot of really high growth, you know, pro investor markets with some really good operators. So when I invest passively in these types of projects, guys that's what they do.
Yeah,
they, you know, manage very successfully thousands and thousands and thousands of units, and when opportunities come up, try to invest in them.
Spinning back to you and your brother, you got your parents as a model, and you guys have this property, center of the island, center of the universe, sort of, if you think about it, this derelict property. Tell me about you and your brother kind of figuring that out and pulling the trigger and doing that next step. Because when everyone hears about it, they think, well, of course.
Yeah.
But at some point, it wasn't even a thing, so.
I've never had a problem pulling the trigger. The way I looked at that transaction, so it's the old Grange building in Middletown that's been vacant for 12 years.
Even longer than that, because it just was barely used if it was used back in the day.
Very minor, right? Yeah. and never developed, so it's just a building on grass, basically.
Yeah.
But everyone knows about the building. You know, it's never really been of, but what's crazy that we've brought it back to life, like, we have customers that come in. I went to school here in 1968 because it was a school. I know more history about this thing now. But it was a school when they were building Gaudet Middle School.
Okay.
So the old Peckham School, they would for 2 or 3 years, it was used as a school house as well. So there's like, it's an amazing building with great history. But when I look at investments like that, I ask myself, like, all right, what's the downside, right? Like, all right, so let's say we buy it and it wasn't cheap. It was, especially for its condition.
Yeah.
We put in a lot of work to it. But I also look at it and say, okay, what's the worst case scenario of like the exit on this thing? And I think for me to be able to pull the trigger on something, I've learned from different people I've worked with over the years, is you don't just look at the upside, because I mean, the upside's always the sexy part. Yeah. But if you look at the downside, you like the upside and you can pallet the downside.
Yeah.
Then I think it's
an off ramp.
That's what I mean. If like, will it take me down?
Yeah.
If it doesn't go the way we plan, and that's why we did it, and you know, didn't plan on opening it during COVID.
Who did, right?
You know, it's so funny how people come in. It's like, that's awesome. You guys opened during COVID. It's like, well, we didn't have a choice.
The train's running,
right? Yeah. And that's one thing that athletics has taught me too, is like, you're going to have adversity, you know, so if your starting tackle goes down, the game still happens on Friday,
right?
It's like, you don't,
next play,
next player, next deal. Like that's one great thing about athletics is, you show up to a wrestling match and you don't feel well that day or you got hurt in practice. Like the match is still on Tuesday.
Yeah.
So that's what I really like about athletics too. And I think has served us well in business is, you're gonna have different obstacles that come up, and frankly, my lawyer makes fun of me. He calls me Lemonade, and that's his nickname for me, because he's like, you always got the lemonade side. I'm like, I don't. I also look at the downside, but you have to look at the opportunity in front of you, just for your own mental well-being, rather than all the problems you have, because that's a natural tendency for everybody, right? Especially as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, you get hit with something, you're like, oh my gosh, how am I gonna deal with this? Because you got 14 other problems that you're dealing with. It just depends on what side of the spectrum you're in.
Yeah.
I mean, I personally am in two of the worst COVID businesses. But again, during the other times, non-COVID, I was in two great, so it's, I think it all evens out over the, I wish I would, last 6 months, I wish I was in the vinyl glove manufacturing business or,
mask making.
That's what I mean. If you're in the mask business, you were like this thrown to the side business, no one, not sexy at all. And now all of a sudden you're just like the king.
We're
you're
the
like,
best.
You're like, it just, right. It's weird how it works.
So, as people are listening to this, a lot of our clients are entrepreneurial, own their own companies, which is exciting for me because I'm of the same bent. But someone who's either about to be an entrepreneurial, they have that engine in them, or they've already started a company and they're in the whirlwind. What do you have for folks like that?
If I look back at some decisions I've made that are well in business, some that are not, and you look at situations handled and situations not. Try to look at inflection points, right? And like where have you had the biggest growth and the biggest trajectory? And I think everyone looks for like that magic pill, right? Or the magic button of like, oh my gosh, I need this, or if I only had this, right? But I truly believe business becomes a lot easier when you have the right people on the bus. I've learned that from just my own situations, external observations, even just staffing businesses, you're like, man, if I had eight of those, my life would be way easier, And so just trying to have the right people that can make you better, hold you accountable, and vice versa. Just people in your life, in other areas of your life too, is always really, really helpful. Because that's where I've, we want our business to grow, but sometimes we don't focus on our growth personally, right? So as we can, if we can become better, we can serve our team better. And when they look and want to be around you more, they'll work harder for you. It's like this constant
balance. Sounds like a Ralph Plum Sr. Comment, right?
I don't know.
That's your dad did that in spades. So I think that's kind of neat that you're echoing those conversations. I have a friend, Lillian, who said, regardless of what business you're in the people business. She's in the cleaning business, and you think, she's like, we're not. We're in the people business. She focused on the people. All of a sudden, the door's all opened.
I know a lot of people in every profession that are really talented, really skillful, really, smart, really, all this stuff, but don't run good businesses. Sometimes I think what happens is, as entrepreneurs, we get stuck on our problems and our situations, but no one cares about our problems, mm-hmm. right? When you're the entrepreneur and the business owner, no one cares about your problem. They care about their problems.
Sure.
And understood, right? And it's, by the way, personal relationships and all this other stuff, same, like simple book around that, like How to Win Friends and Influence People, right? That's what that book is, right? Stop worrying about your own stuff. When you're working with team members or even clients or customers, you have to put a pause on your problems whenever you're doing those interactions or, And me, one of my challenges and one of my really things I try to work on is I can be intense sometimes, which is good in some ways, but really detrimental in other ways, because not everyone likes that intensity. Yeah. And sometimes I don't, right? Yeah. But being self-aware of your own strengths, weaknesses, work on your weaknesses and celebrate your strengths. Yeah. And
is there anything you think of daily, you do daily, or not, maybe not daily, but you do consistently that you feel has sort of honed your skills or that has given you an advantage? Anything that you could pass on to people? I say, man, if I started doing that a little bit more, I would reap rewards.
Yeah, it's weird. There's so many other things in business that matter other than just the technical thing that you're doing, whether mm-hmm. it's a restaurant, a training, an event, a design of a building. There's so all this other stuff. What a good question of what do you do daily? There's probably 8,000 things I need to be more consistent at to improve.
Yeah.
Consistency is important in anything. You can start with fitness and all that stuff. But I think one thing that helps me is when I fall behind, in business you can work on a lot of projects, you have a lot of open projects, but trying to finish things and setting deadlines to things, as an entrepreneur you can always, I'll get to that tomorrow. Procrastination can be a really tough thing for a lot of people, but as a business owner, you now have 8,000 open projects.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to quote unquote, so like prioritizing, but then like trying to get stuff to the finish line, mm-hmm. even if it's like designing a sign or if it's like getting back to someone on like,
okay.
I think closing open items.
Oh, there you go.
I just tried to clear my desk of stuff.
Yeah.
Like close out open things. Mm-hmm. So that way I could further focus on other stuff. That's just for me in my head that helps.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause like, that's I don't good. Know about you, but you, when you go to your desk, you're going to have, you're gonna have 20 things you could do at yeah. this one time.
Right.
So if I can get a lot of those little things off my desk, so then I can focus on bigger projects.
Yeah, because we're good at opening up jars, right? Like, as visionaries and entrepreneurs, like, oh, we're gonna do this, and we're gonna do this, we're gonna do this, and suddenly there's this like vast array of half opened.
And sometimes we're like, it doesn't matter, but I think just only internally, and I've learned this from a buddy of mine, like the guy just is relentless.
Solid.
And finishes. Hey, I'm gonna have this for you on Tuesday. It is there on Tuesday, mm-hmm. man.
Okay.
And I've seen it for 20 years.
Mm.
And he's probably one of the most successful guys I know.
Well, thank you, Ralph. We're gonna close it up now, but anybody listening needs a new restaurant to go to. Plummies is open in the middle of Middletown. And we were, as an architecture firm, happy to be part of that project and many others for the Plum family, his parents' houses and stuff. So just knowing your family, knowing you, knowing your brother, knowing your mom and dad, you guys just impact so many people so positively. One of the people that I would say are on my top five is your family and the impact that you guys have had on me, both professionally and personally. So I want to thank you guys.
Thanks, bud. Appreciate you having me.
Thank you.